Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So we got into it primarily from a pet standpoint because my daughter was interested in that. But as a family, we were interested in sustainability and gardening and producing our own food.
So Alicia Kropf started a small chicken flock in her backyard in Bloomington, Indiana. She'll be joined by two other backyard chicken farmers for our roundtable discussion. Before that, Harvest Public Media says the cooperative will be the fastest growing business model in the next 10 years. In the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr assembles the world's best BLT and a decadent goat cheese appetizer. And Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana visits a pie shop in Atlanta, Indiana, and brings us a story of entrepreneurship, innovation, and community. Welcome to Luann Johnson here with our headlines.
In case you've missed it, we have a farm bill. Sort of. The trimmed-down Federal Agriculture Reform and Risk Management Act barely squeezed through on a 216-208 vote last Thursday, after hours of heated debate and angry barbs hurled across the chamber floor. House Republicans sheared the bill into two parts, separating food stamp provisions from farm assistant programs for the first time in four decades. The move was meant to boost the chamber's chances to pass a farm bill, and most importantly, to avoid repeating the embarrassing defeat of a broader measure in June. The bill cuts a controversial system that allowed wealthy business to get subsidies, but it shifts three-quarters of the savings into a new program that guarantees farms would get up to 90% of the profits they make the previous year. The bill also locks in recent record-high prices for certain crops, which opponents say could cost taxpayers billions of dollars if prices drop over the next decade. The agribusiness lobby is among the most powerful in Washington, and it certainly threw its might into the fray over this measure during the last 2 years. In 2012 alone, Big Ag spent $220 million on lobbying and campaign contributions, according to public records. Here are the latest numbers on the cyclospora outbreak in the United States Midwest. 87 sickened in Iowa, 53 in Nebraska. There could be an additional 37 cases in Texas, and undisclosed numbers in Illinois and Wisconsin. Cyclospora is a single-celled parasite and is considered an emerging pathogen. In the United States, cyclospora outbreaks have predominantly been linked to imported fresh produce, including raspberries, basil, snow peas, and mesclun lettuce. Investigators are still working to identify the outbreak source, though they are suspecting a raw vegetable product that is no longer on the market. And 21 school children are dead in India after eating rice, beans, and potato curry, likely contaminated with a highly toxic chemical often used in insecticides and solvents. Officials say the school lunch was either contaminated or became contaminated during preparation. India's National School Lunch Program serves free meals to 120 million children in its 73,000 schools. In 2001, the India Supreme Court ordered school lunches be provided, and the program has since grown into the world's largest. Find links to these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and hear about stories just like these right as we do. The place to get the latest food news is twitter.com/eartheats.
And we want to give a big welcome to our new blogger, Chad Bouchard. He's contributed works to outlets like NPR and Scientific American, to name a few. He's lived in Indonesia, now based in New York City. We're so excited to have him on board. Luann Johnson reads his reports in our news headlines every episode. Thanks.
See you next week.
One in five adults over the age of 15 is a member of a cooperative, according to the United Nations. That's 1 billion people worldwide. And the UN says co-ops will be the fastest growing business model by the year 2025. But here in the U.S., the number of co-ops has been steadily declining, down 40% from 1993. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stowes Krause finds that the co-op model, long a staple of Midwestern agricultural communities, is being redefined in ways big and small.
Basically, everything you see is as new as a almost 100-year-old building can be. One of the things that we did save is the tin ceiling.
Elwood is a town of 700 people in south-central Nebraska. Charlotte Schwenninger gives me a tour of the town's new cooperative grocery store.
I get very emotional almost every time I'm in here because I'm just so happy to have this store. And I think it's something that we're going to be proud of for a long time.
The store is an example of how the cooperative, or co-op, business model is being adapted in rural communities.
There's this variety, like you said, the grocery stores, and then there's the worker co-ops, and ag co-ops, and marketing co-ops, and credit unions are cooperatives. Typically, the bottom line is that it's member-owned, member-controlled, member-benefited.
Co-ops are businesses owned by community members, who pay a membership fee and in return receive financial benefits and voting power, she says. They've been around in the U.S. since 1752, mostly in agriculture. Today, one-third of the nation's top 100 largest cooperatives can be found in the five-state region of Nebraska, South Dakota, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 1993, 848 ag-related cooperatives operated in the region. By 2007, that number had been cut almost in half.
What has happened is cooperatives have converged to make them competitive in the world market.
That's Ed Wobble with the Nebraska Cooperative Council. He shows me a map of ag co-ops in Nebraska, and it's covered with what look like neurons or maybe fireworks, central dots showing the co-op's headquarters with lines that stretch outward in every direction to indicate local branches. The 39 co-ops that belong to the council operate in 352 locations. But as ag co-ops have gone global, other hyper-local co-ops, like the Elwood Grocery Store, have been springing up in greater numbers as rural populations age.
Hi, Marvin.
Hi.
Can we get something?
Take Wallback, a bedroom community in north-central Nebraska who gave the co-op model a try when the town grocery store announced it was closing.
We had high hopes for it.
That's Mina Sprague, one of the founding members of Frogs, or First Rural Organic Grocery Store. The co-op opened in January of 2011. Earlier this year, it shut down.
And we're sad, but it's kind of a relief not to have to worry about who's working and who's covering the store.
Frogs succumbed to two big challenges common to retail co-ops, especially in small towns and rural areas. Their plan relied heavily on volunteerism, but as the town's initial enthusiasm slowly died off, the board members found themselves putting in more and more hours. There was also the issue of competition with stores in surrounding communities, says fellow board member Dave Sprague. In particular, a city 40 miles south, where much of Wallback's population already travels for work.
And once you're down there for 8 hours, well, you might as well shop there. And we cannot compete with Walmart.
Back in Elwood, Schwenninger says they tried to break habits of shopping in nearby, bigger Lexington by focusing on the economic benefits to the local community.
If they spend money in Elwood, it, you know, 54 cents out of every dollar stays in town. If we shop in Lexington, 15 cents out of every dollar stays in Lexington, and none of it comes to Elwood.
Additionally, Schwenninger says since the cost and risk of buying and remodeling the store was spread across a wide group of people, the rewards will be spread across the community too.
Because we were pooling money, we were able to do it right. That's kind of what the beauty of a cooperative in a small town is.
The Elwood Co-op has only been open a few months, and there are still challenges. But Schwenninger says she has faith the community will work together to make it successful. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hillary Stose-Krause.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Last week, one of the main stories in the food universe was about chickens being abandoned at local animal shelters. Time magazine blamed hipsters for ditching birds because they were too much work. NPR said roosters are to blame more than anything. You can be in touch with your local animal shelter to see what's going on in your community. This all got us thinking. Maybe wannabe backyard chicken farmers just don't know everything it takes to raise a flock, or perhaps you have questions and you just don't know who to ask. That's where our three veteran chicken farmers come in. We got a roundtable together last fall. This conversation will be especially interesting to gardeners who are thinking about adding chickens to the mix. Let's start with Alicia Kropf.
We have five chickens, which is the in-town limit, and we live on a small city lot. I think, is it an eighth of an acre? Is that right? I don't even know. It's tiny.
It's your backyard.
Right? It's my backyard. We live in the Bryan Park neighborhood, so they're not. These are not big lots.
I'm Jana Wilson, and I guess I'm the country chick. I live out on. I have 20 acres outside of the city, and I have anywhere from 25 in the winter to 80 to 90 in the summer because I hatch.
And I'm Tom Barrich. I live just on the outskirts of Bloomington, so I'm at just outside the city limit. So I have eight birds, mixed flock, and I am starting to hatch as well. And it's very much suburbs, but just outside the city limits.
So you don't have to follow the city rules?
No, we don't.
And Alicia, let's talk about that. What are the rules that you have to follow since you are in the city of Bloomington?
Okay, well, they just changed recently. So the rules that we have to follow is you can have a limit of five birds. They all have to be hens. You can have no roosters, cockerels, anything like that. You have to have an enclosure for those birds that I believe is 60 square feet for five birds. You have to have that enclosure has to be a certain specific number of feet from every other piece, every other building nearby. So it has to be so many feet from my fence, from my neighbors, from the neighbors behind me. Mm-hmm. You no longer have to have neighborhood permission, although it's nice to tell them.
Mm-hmm. That's a change.
That is
a change.
Sure.
That's a huge change. That's a change that happened at the city council last spring.
Mm-hmm. So then you guys who are not in the city, is it just sort of like a free-for-all? You can do whatever you want on the farm?
Well, with my experience being still in the suburbs and heavily suburbs, I have neighbors on all sides. I don't want to say that it's a free-for-all because there's a matter of neighborly courtesy that you have to keep with. And really, as long as you check with all of your neighbors, make sure that, you know, if you do let your chickens free range, which I do on occasion, you know, they're not bothering them. I do have a rooster, which is one of the things that, you know, Alicia can't do. And even though we live in the same kind of area, you know, you do want to check with them because at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're going to have this animal screaming bloody murder in the backyard.
Well, gosh, what are the perks of having a rooster other than this alarm clock?
Chicks.
That's well, and it. Predators, they help guard a flock.
Absolutely. And especially if you have your chickens free range a bit, you know, they will keep dogs away. and they'll keep other things away, though.
What breed do you have?
I have a Bard Rock rooster.
Yeah, because my roosters are completely useless.
Really?
Completely useless. They're
wow.
Lovely little birds. Sicilian buttercups.
Okay, sure.
They're small.
Yeah, they're little things.
Yeah, but completely useless.
Well, so. Let's talk about your birds, because you raise interesting birds, Jana. These Sicilian buttercups.
Mm-hmm, they are. In the American Livestock Breed Conservancy listing, they used to be threatened. I believe they've taken a step up, and now they're critical. I think that's the difference. So they're not as threatened as they used to be, but there are very, very few of them around. They, as time has gone on, a lot of heritage breeds have suffered this fate of they're almost extinct because the production birds are just one or two different breeds. And so people, farmers, you know, quit raising various types of breeds in their backyards because it wasn't productive. It wasn't economical for them.
Let's describe what they look like. They're beautiful.
They really are. Well, the most distinctive feature about them is their comb. It's a cup, a circular cup on top of their head. The comb is, mm-hmm. is you could put, an egg inside of a male's comb. It's a very large comb. And the females are a beautiful golden color with a spangling from their shoulders back, the black spangling. And they're great egg layers.
They are.
Yeah, they're like the leghorn.
Mm-hmm. Do they work as dual purpose at all? Do you eat them?
I do eat them. Mm-hmm. I do eat them. They're not considered a meat bird or a mm-hmm. production bird. Like most egg-laying birds, most of their energy goes right into the eggs. And so they're pretty skinny little things.
Yeah.
Hence those wimpy males
yeah,
are
the
not
don't do
really
anything.
Good at fending off predators.
Sure. We're talking about what you use your chickens for. So we've got eggs and for meat. What are some of the other things that chickens give you?
I can answer that one. For us, anyway. So we got into it primarily from a pet standpoint because my daughter was interested in that. But as a family, we were interested in sustainability and gardening and producing our own food. And because some of ours have a pet designation, they're never going to be marked for the axe. They just never will be. But I use my chickens primarily for eggs. I also use their droppings for compost in all my gardens.
Yes, absolutely.
And based on what I have planted where, I funnel them into different areas of my yards to do my tilling because they're much more efficient. And I'm a really lazy gardener. And if I can put my chickens in there for a day and they can dig up everything and turn all the soil,
absolutely,
it's better for me.
Yeah. And you want to move them frequently because, as Alicia said, they'll tear up anything, which is, if you want them to tear up stuff, it's great. But if you don't, you have to keep moving them around or they will turn any patch of earth, grass into dirt. So, mine too.
Like to go on there and
they
do
don't
their thing.
Eat the vegetables?
I found that mine go for the bugs first.
Well, the thing we've discovered is that in regards to the vegetables and the bugs, yes, they absolutely are going to go for the bugs first. But the problem is if you've got bugs on tomatoes, they're just going to spear the tomatoes. Mm-hmm. They'll actually destroy the tomatoes that
they
way.
And that's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, not for the chicken.
No, it's exactly. It's delicious
for them.
But
there are ways around it. You know, we have a small garden area, and I do plant things that will spill out over so that they can eat what comes over the fence. Or, you know, there are people who plant like a moat, like between where their garden is, not a literal moat full of water, but like you'll dig out so there's space so a chicken can't put its head through the fence and actually get the vegetables. Or you can do other plants. I'll plant various tomatoes and things around my yard for them to free range in. Mm-hmm. So,
because they're pretty tenacious, you know.
They are.
They'll stick their heads out and really go for a lot if they're inside of a fence. Yes. They're very tenacious.
I have a grape arbor that they're just, I've had to really, it's like grape Fort Knox. I mean, we have to really, really, really clean it.
I mean, the cliche is the chickens are dumb, but and while that may be, they're actually very wily. They're survivors.
Hear my complete conversation with Alicia, Tom, and Jana on our website, eartheats.org. If you have more questions about raising backyard chickens, ask them on our Twitter feed. Just search for Earth Eats. Coming up.
All right, now we're going to put a layer of this goat cheese, a layer of some tomatoes, some basil leaves. All right, and then I'm going to put the bacon on top of that.
That's Chef Daniel Orr working his magic in the kitchen. Two recipes coming up. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Our partnership with Traditional Arts Indiana continues today with a story about innovation, tradition, and the simple pleasures of a favorite local diner or cafe. We visit Lisa's Pie Shop in Atlanta, Indiana. Lisa Sparks started her business with only about $254. She credits her patrons with making her pie shop as successful as it is.
I myself don't like pies. So I've never tasted most of the pies. And when I say that the customers truly make my pie shop, that's truly the truth because they're the ones that made the recipes.
She relies on customers to tell her what she needed to add to the pies. Josephine McRobbie has more.
On the peaceful and pastoral U.S. Highway 31 between Indianapolis and Kokomo stands a modest building with a sign reading Lisa's Pie Shop. The store's namesake and owner, Lisa Sparks, says that the store is not out in the middle of nowhere, but actually out in the middle of everywhere, in between a number of highly trafficked Indiana towns. Lisa takes me back to the kitchen, where she's working on rolling out dough with Honey, who is one of her employees and adopted children. The walls are lined with family photos and letters and inspirational signage, including a handmade list titled The 10 Commandments for Women in the Workplace. Right away, it's clear that this small shop is a special place. When Lisa was young, she was diagnosed with cancer. This event completely changed the course of her life, both professionally and philosophically.
And they told me at 29 that I had cancer. I worked in the factory at the time. Well, after I had the cancer and I went back to work and I realized that life was too short. It didn't matter how much money I made. It was too short to go back someplace where you didn't want to be. So I knew after I got out of the hospital and stuff that I wasn't going to go back to the factory. I didn't care what I had to do.
Despite the fact that she doesn't like pies, Lisa's shop came to garner a number of national awards for pie making. But she keeps in mind that it's the people surrounding her that make the store successful.
I am very thankful for what we won, but I also understand that we wouldn't be anything. You know, I could go compete every day of the year and win every day of the year, but if we didn't have the good customers to buy them, then we wouldn't be anything.
Originally from Kokomo, Lisa financed many of her early kitchen purchases by running detasseling crews in the cornfields, a job she held for 30 years. Patience and a talent for shrewd money management are perhaps Lisa's greatest strengths as a small business owner.
We didn't charge anything. I didn't use credit for anything. Each one of these ovens, everything that you see in here, I bought one at a time because I promised my husband that I would not get him in debt. I would not use credit cards. And so I didn't. And so I did everything the hard way. It made it to where I didn't have to come to work in order to pay bills. I got to come to work in order to make an investment. You know, so many small businesses think they have to have everything right now. I wasn't like that. I didn't want to go home and close my eyes and have to worry about how that bill was going to get paid. This is more than just a pie shop. This is someplace that you can come and we're family here. We're family, and we make our employees part of the family.
Hear more stories about Hoosier food traditions from Traditional Arts Indiana through their second serving series. Their website is traditionalartsindiana.org. Tomatoes are starting to look really great this time of year. Pick up your favorite heirloom variety and make this BLT. Now, this is not a simple sandwich. You might have to do a little shopping to get all the ingredients you'll need, but it is worth it.
We're going to start by having lightly toasted bread, and I'm going to take a garlic clove, and we're just going to rub that garlic clove on the bread. So we have a little, starting out with a little layering of flavors.
It's interesting. I've never seen you do this. A little essence of garlic.
Yeah, it's a great way to make garlic bread. If you have just some nice crusty toasted bread, you rub that garlic and you see how it comes off onto the bread. All right, now we're going to put a layer of this goat cheese. Nice thick layer.
The more the better.
We'll layer some tomatoes, some basil leaves, and I'm just using regular Italian basil, but if you wanted to, you could use some Thai basil or some lemon basil. Switch it up with whatever you have. All right, and then I'm going to put the bacon on top of that. And then we're going to pop this in the oven. And then when it comes out, we're going to finish it with the avocado and the lettuce.
That couldn't have been in there more than a couple minutes.
Yeah, about 4 or 5 minutes, hot oven. Okay, we're going to just take this out, put it on our cutting board. All right, we have some wasabi basil mayonnaise. We're going to cut an avocado. What you can do is just simply cut the avocado in half, twist it, And then you can make little slices. We'll fan that across here.
Smush it down.
For me, that's the ultimate summer sandwich. Those nice summer tomatoes, basil right out of the garden. It's always good when the restaurant's silent. That means everybody's eating their food.
We used some soft Capriole goat cheese on that sandwich. Consider picking up a huge batch of the stuff to make this high-class cheese ball. This was from our Christmas episode, but cheese really is great all times of year.
All right, so I've got about a pound of good goat cheese. This is from Capriole Farms. Judy Shad makes this wonderful soft goat cheese, and she would hate to see you use one of her aged goat cheeses, you know, like the Old Kentucky Tome, for cooking, but she loves to see her fresh goat cheese used. You know, when you do an aged goat cheese, there's a lot of love and passion put into that and the whole way that it's aged and processed, whereas the fresh goat cheese just begs to be played with. And so we're going to do that today. I'm going to make this a little bit sweet and a little bit savory, you know. So we have some dried cherries. You could use cranberries. We're going to rough chop some pecans. And you could use any kind of nuts. We're going to use the pecans. I just think of pecans taste a lot like Christmas to me. And we're also going to throw some bacon in this.
Of course.
So I've got some Mariah bacon from Columbus, Indiana. It's a peppered bacon, smoked pepper bacon. We're going to cut these into little pieces. All right. Now we're just going to mix this up. And again, you can use your hands. One of the best tools in the kitchen. And we're going to season this with some salt and pepper. Okay, I would say for about a pound and a half of cheese, we'll use a good teaspoon of pepper and teaspoon of salt. Remember, you can always add more, but you can't take it out once it's in there. So just mix it in and then taste it and see how you like it. You could put fresh herbs in here, some chives or some rosemary, whatever you like.
It's like a softball of goat cheese right now.
So we got that, and now what we can do is we can decorate it. And take some rosemary leaves and just kind of press them into the outside. A little bit of thyme. And there you have it. That's a nice local goat cheese ball with bacon and dried cherries.
Two awesome recipes today. Both can be found on our website along with pictures. You can watch videos and read interviews as well. Find your next favorite dish at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Ahabon Binder, Tom Barrich, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Alicia Kropp, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Josephine McRobbie, Hilary Stowes Krause, Jana Wilson, and everyone at Harvest Public Media and Traditional Arts Indiana. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We appreciate you tuning in today. Have a great one. I'm Annie Corrigan.